Well, good morning. What we'll do this morning, I think, is this. We've been looking at tribal government in the lower 48 and in Alaska for the last 2 days. And this morning we'll begin by asking Peter Jull and Frederick Harhoff and Cindy Gilday and Ted Chamberlain to tell us something about developments in other countries. And then we'll go on from there to the uses of state-chartered governments and their counterparts, and in that connection, Rex Okakuk of the North Slope Borough is going to be joining us, I believe. Senator Vic Fisher of the State Senate is with us this morning, seated to Willie Casale's left, and we welcome Senator Fisher. And Bill Dubay of the Arctic Policy Review has a submission to make as well when we reach that subject. And it may be that we can ask Peter Jull and Frederick Harhoff to tell us something about the Kativik regional government in northern Quebec and about Greenland as well. So with that as our program for the morning, perhaps we might begin. After that, I would like to return to the subjects on the agenda for the afternoon, and to return as well at that time to some questions that are still troubling me about the possibility of native land being held in fee, about the question of secretarial supervision as a concomitant of the trust relationship, and so on. I think we should explore those subjects a little further, if we may. And I was going to suggest that we consider the question of the state-tribal interface a little further at that stage as well. So, having said that, maybe we could begin, and maybe I could ask Peter Jull, who is with ICC Canada, to start the discussion off.
Thanks, Tom. I'm sorry that the Canadian Inuit leaders are unable to be here. They're in Ottawa at the moment at an Aboriginal summit of the Indian, Métis, and Inuit people preparing for a constitutional conference. And, of course, the main subject in these constitutional conferences is the question of self-government. The Canadian situation is quite interesting because although the Aboriginal population in Canada is perhaps not more than 5%, if that, of the total population, it's spread in such a way that in the northern portions of the country, the northern perhaps 75% of Canada, these peoples are in a majority situation in most areas, and therefore have all kinds of opportunities to influence development policies and other policies in very large areas.
Can you move the mic a little closer? Sorry.
So I would mention that despite the dangers of looking at cases in other countries, and given the differences in political culture, constitutional conventions, and so on, that in Canada at the moment there are a great many experiments, you might say, or proposals in Aboriginal self-government which are at various stages of development, and there will be many more coming up over the next few years. So you might say that Canada is a virtual laboratory of these things, and they take many forms, and each form perhaps has a certain logic in the local situation. But for those of you interested in these subjects, I think over the next years you'll find a great many things to think about in Canada. The one that I would talk about a little further is the Nunavut case, partly because it's moving along fairly well, partly because it's a large one, and I suppose mostly because I'm very closely connected with it. Nunavut is a concept which, well, the word Nunavut simply means our land and is a normal phrase of the Inuit in northern Canada, but in its political sense, in recent years, since the Northwest Territories Inuit have developed their proposals for land claim settlements, an integral part of their proposal was Nunavut, meaning a government over their traditional homeland, which they were controlling and which would provide the kinds of protections and attention to their interests which other governments didn't provide. To give you one example of that, the Northwest Territories government has no jurisdiction of any kind in relation to the ocean or offshore questions. All the Inuit communities, with one exception, are coastal. The whole question of the ocean and its management, pollution, marine transportation, and so on, are absolutely essential to Inuit, so this is obviously something where they would like more attention. Now, under Canadian jurisdictional conventions at the moment, they perhaps cannot hope for a great deal of jurisdiction all at once. On the other hand, if you've got a government that has the resources to hire staff and conduct studies and so on, there's a great deal you can do, especially in a country like Canada, where a very important element in our practicing constitutional structure is what's called executive federalism, meaning the executives, the cabinets of the national government and the provincial and territorial governments sitting down together and working out policies and programs. There's well over 300 such committees, the highest of which you might say is the Prime Minister and the provincial premiers, but also ministers of finance, ministers of welfare, everything down to officials in charge of student loans programs and so on. A great deal of Canada's public business is conducted in this kind of format, which by definition is beyond the reach of legislatures in their ordinary course. Of course, this is something that troubles a lot of constitutionalists in Canada, but it's a fact of life. So a Nunavut government paying attention to offshore issues, even without immediate jurisdiction, could do a very great deal. The question of Nunavut is one, first of all, of dividing the present Northwest Territories, which represents something over one-third of the total land area of Canada, dividing that into two new jurisdictions, the one in the west being probably called Denendeh, the homeland of the Dene people, and in the east, Nunavut, the homeland of Inuit. A plebiscite was conducted in 1982, and the people in the east voted 4-1 for creation of Nunavut, and they did so in a voter turnout that was unprecedented. It was very, very high, and it was so high that the Canadian government couldn't possibly ignore it. The Canadian government had been doing a lot of studies of plebiscites because they were nervous about referendums on independence in Quebec, so they knew that a 4-1 turnout in a very high, 4-1 vote in a very high turnout was a very significant statement. It was the more significant because the press had been wandering around saying that really people didn't know very much about the situation and weren't really well prepared, but the Inuit just weren't telling, I guess. Following the plebiscite, the Northwest Territories legislature voted 19-0 to create new bodies to start working out the details of the new territories. These bodies were kind of mixed. The Northwest Territories Legislative Assembly, equivalent to your state legislature, except without as much power, the Legislative Assembly had set up a committee a couple of years earlier which had come back with the amazing report that the legislature and indeed the present boundaries of the Northwest Territories were not meaningful or acceptable to the people, especially the native people of the Northwest Territories. So in a sense, the legislature had shot itself in the foot, and this was not a bad thing. The Northwest Territories is the residual area in Canada. It used to be much larger, and over the years, Canada would chop up part of it and create the Yukon Territory or create the province of Alberta. So what's left is, in a sense, a vestigial area. It didn't have an inherent logic, and it did contain, as I said, two indigenous homelands, the homeland of the Dene and the homeland of the Inuit. These new bodies created are rather like the New Ireland Forum, which was supposed to bring peace to Ireland and perhaps has not succeeded. It contained the leaders from the Nunavut area or the Denendeh area, and in each case there's the Western Constitutional Forum and the Nunavut Constitutional Forum, together with the elected leaders of the Aboriginal groups. So the Western Constitutional Forum has the Dene and Métis leaders as well as people from the Legislative Assembly, and the Nunavut Forum has the Kolp and Inuit Tepirisat leaders with a cabinet minister from Frobisher Bay and another member from North Baffin Island. These two groups set out working. They've worked in somewhat different ways, reflecting the needs and differences in their areas. In the Nunavut case, because there was already pretty well complete social and political consensus in the area on the need for Nunavut, what was decided was to proceed with, as quickly as we could, with a concrete proposal and with some studies on division of powers between a Nunavut government. But the basic project was to create a territorial government not unlike the existing Northwest Territories in jurisdiction, but something which over time would evolve as other areas of Canada had evolved to full provincehood. In other words, we're talking about a potential province, not immediately, but someday, and that's presumably the destiny of any area of Canada under the present constitutional approach. And for the time being, however, a self-governing territory was what was sought. In Canada, that's not exactly a great novelty. Everybody knows, and everybody in school learns that in Section 91, Section 92 of the Canadian Constitution, there's two lists of powers, one for the national government, one for provincial government. Nevertheless, there were many people, especially in Ottawa, who were concerned that a new territory, especially one that was ethnically based, they said, would be very dangerous. That they seemed to fear that the Inuit would start legislating against Beethoven or something. It was pointed out, of course, that Nova Scotia, the easternmost one of the eastern provinces, is also ethnically based. 85% of the people are Anglo-Celtic, or rather, let's say Celtic. Every province in Canada has a similar composition. Nunavut would be no more ethnically exclusive to one group than any other area of Canada. On the other hand, the other areas are dominated by European descended populations, and Nunavut would be different in that sense. It would be a group of people speaking a non-European language with a non-European culture. And one can only speculate the extent to which that's been a factor in people's thinking. Anyway, in order to play the game, we went to work producing little documents, and we produced one called Building Nunavut, a very glossy booklet here, in four languages, French and English and two Inuit languages. And really all it is an outline of the various powers typical of a territorial or provincial government jurisdiction in Canada, and explaining that we were looking at familiar structures. In each section, there's an explanation of why these areas are of interest and of particular importance in Nunavut and what the particular concerns in the Nunavut area would be in relation to them. But in a sense, the document's function was as much to reassure a jittery government in Ottawa as anything else. We thought that this would precipitate negotiations with Ottawa, and in that we were surprised because there was a deafening silence. We found that people thought our book was interesting, and they thought it was somewhat reassuring, but nothing much happened. We continued with a number of things, a number of studies, holding public meetings and so on, and the most valuable thing was a series of community hearings in every community in the Nunavut area. These hearings were useful because they gave the people in the communities an opportunity to voice their impatience and their strong support for creation of a Nunavut government, but at the same time there were some cautions. And I suppose the most significant one was Inuit in the Northwest Territories have been pushed around and socially engineered for a generation and a half now, so that when you come talking about a marvelous new government, there's a somewhat ambivalent feeling. Certainly, people want a Nunavut government, one that they will control, but precisely that point is the subject of concern. To what extent will it be controlled by local people, meaning will the local people have the qualifications and the opportunities to fill the jobs so that the administration is sensitive to local interests? The great fear being that it'll be another government where people move in from Ottawa and try to turn Inuit into some kind of a replica of a southern industrial society. So the whole question of job preparation, accelerated training programs, and so on is of the greatest possible interest. And that's one area where those of us working with Nunavut will be very interested to see how the North Slope Borough and other groups in Alaska have succeeded in increasing local employment. The community hearings had a downside. People in Ottawa who were following them, the people who advised the government on constitutional issues, seemed to judge them not as a political sentiment by the people in the communities, which is what they were, but rather as some kind of college seminar where people were to be marked on their capacity to express complex issues of offshore jurisdiction or whatever. There was a certain unrealism about it all, and this was kind of frustrating because people were voicing deep felt concerns about their minority status and their inability to use their own language, even in their own village where no other language was spoken by the local people and so on. And yet we felt that some of the people in Ottawa tended to see the exercise as academic and perhaps use the wrong criteria for judging it. Fortunately, however, at the political level, and in Canada in the last year we've had an interesting political level. We've had three prime ministers this year, so policies are somewhat confused, but we've found that all the politicians have been reasonably responsive to the claims of the people in Nunavut. Another thing that's come out in the meetings is that despite the strong regionalism in Nunavut, and remember that the area we're talking about is larger than the entire state of Alaska, there's naturally some strong regions, but regardless of that, the main area of Nunavut, the Eastern Arctic, the representatives on the regional councils did meet with the Nunavut Constitutional Forum and said that, yes, they wanted to have certain regional structures in order to deliver public services more efficiently, but that they felt it was more important to have a strong Nunavut central government, one that was capable of dealing with Ottawa, taking on Ottawa on issues like the offshore, and having the resources to strongly represent the cultural unity and the overall interests of the people of Nunavut. I think that's a significant thing. To conclude, The people in Nunavut are really working at three levels, and this is true of other groups in northern Canada. There's the settlement of land claims, and through land claims, of course, we don't mean just land. There's a number of issues, but matters of self-government, of all kinds of things can be brought in, preferential hiring, whatever. And these are very important issues now because since 1982, a new constitutional amendment provides that any land claim settlement is safe from the operation of the Canadian Constitutional Charter of Rights. In other words, any rights extended through a land claim settlement, such as preferential hiring practices, and that's an important one, would take precedence over, let's say, the new clause in the Constitution on mobility rights, which would guarantee any Canadian the right to move anywhere in the country to take work. So achieving certain objectives through land claim settlements has a very special importance. Then, of course, there's the move to create the Nunavut government, reflecting the interests of the people in the area. And then the third level is the securing of further protections for Inuit culture, livelihoods, and self-government rights through the national constitution. And as I mentioned at the outset, the Inuit, Dene, and other Canadian Native leaders are now meeting in Ottawa discussing this very point. Thank you.
Peter, could I just ask you a question? We're struggling here at one level with a philosophical question, I suppose, and that is the whether their native people should seek tribal governments, which are of necessity ethnically based, or should be prepared to see their aspirations accommodated in structures of so-called public government, that is, here state-chartered municipal governments. In Nunavut, if this new territory is established, it will have, I take it, predominantly Inuit population, and are there any proposed measures that might be thought of as similar to tribal government? That is, any measures designed to secure the position of the Inuit majority?
Yes. Well, first of all, of course, the land claim settlement would presumably secure many rights, but for the constitution of a Nunavut public government itself, and you're right, the population is about 90% Inuit, and of the remaining percentage, many of the others are transient and short-term workers, and we are seeking a three-year residency requirement for elections, so that a teacher would have to be there 3 years before he or she would be eligible to vote. There would be provision for Inuktitut as an official language alongside English and French. This is very important, and you would think a very basic thing, and yet Canada's main national newspaper has been attacking in editorials one day and ridiculing through cartoons on others at this point. So even though language policy we thought was well accepted in Canada, that's a problem. There is discussion of Inuit customary law, and that's, we were very interested yesterday in the remarks of Mr. Pipestem and others. The whole question of the operation of Inuit customary law and how to develop that. Greenland has had some experience, some of it positive and some of it not. So we've been looking at how Inuit law is working there. But certainly that's a major issue, because for cultural continuity and so on, the whole question of the settlement of disputes in the Northwest Territories today, as you know perhaps better than most, the Inuit simply do not use the administration of justice available through the Canadian state. Disputes either are not settled or are settled in other manners, but in a sense that there's a vacuum there. So finding ways to put certain features like that into the Nunavut Act, which would be an act of the federal parliament and therefore would be beyond the power of shifting majorities or whatever in a Nunavut legislature to effect, or indeed we would want it constitutionally entrenched so it couldn't be easily altered except through the general amending formula in the Constitution. So there are a number of features like that. It's a hard one to address because in Canada there are different constitutional conventions than there are in the United States and in other countries, and so there are certain subjects such as language which are accepted as ones suitable for legislation in a public government forum, whereas other things are not so considered and have to be dealt with perhaps through a land claims settlement.
David, Case?
I just want to be sure I understand the point. Is it the case that in the Canadian Constitution, if a matter is included as a matter of a land settlement, including the establishment of a Nunavut government, as you, with the three-year residency requirements and all the rest, that overcomes and takes precedence over perhaps contrary provisions of the Constitution, for example, those permitting free mobility?
That's correct, except for one thing, and that is the Nunavut Act would not be brought under the land claim settlement. They would be separate. And for instance, you could achieve some of these things through a land claim settlement, and some of them are important to achieve for that constitutional protection. But at the moment, the thinking is not to have the Nunavut Act itself as part of a land claim settlement, but have it as a separate statute, which can, however, be appended to the Constitution as a constitutional document and given various protection. But yes, anything put in under a land claim settlement, such as preferential hiring, such as decision making on wildlife, whatever, anything in relation to land, subsistence, you name it, anything that's in a land claim settlement is now constitutionally protected. So you couldn't go in and say, well, you know, I don't have equal rights with a Dene person or an Inuk person. It just wouldn't wash. The new constitution protects, gives the land claims settlement precedent.
It overrides the equal protection clause.
But there are other ways that you said that Nunavut would include a 3-year residency requirement, for example.
That's what we're seeking, and there does seem to be no great difficulty yet.
But it's not part of the settlement, a land settlement. It's part of another document, another statute.
That's right.
But it still has it will overcome the problem with free mobility? The question of the right of free mobility?
The mobility clause relates to employment. And effectively then, you know, nobody's going to move into Iglulik unless he's got the prospect of a job and a house and so on. So, you know, a number of these things haven't been fully discussed. For instance, one could make a very strong case, and some of the Inuit communities farther west in the Northwest Territories are making such a case, that land claim settlement should protect certain community government rights. So you might have a dual system where perhaps you had an ethnically based, if you will, community government structure, and then at the Nunavut-wide level, a more open system. I might say that one of the criticisms made by some of the Inuit in the Eastern Northwest Territories of the COPE claim has been that because the community lands are not in the settlement area, it means the loss of certain possibilities for control of local government and so on.
Ralph Johnson.
Yes, this is very helpful, and of course Peter was very helpful yesterday in explaining some of these things to me at lunch. Although I've studied them, it's a lot better to have a personal description. As I understand the process, then the Nunavut have proposed a settlement. That settlement was agreed to and ratified, or is in the process of ratification now by the Canadian government. And then it'll go into legislation, but that essentially will be a land claim settlement. And then the same process might be followed at a later time for the government side of it, for what we're talking about here is the government issue. Is that a fair description of what's going on?
Not quite. There's three things. First of all, on the land claims, there are negotiations underway, and something like 14 or 15 sub-agreements have been initialed between the Nunavut claimants and the Canadian government. We don't know exactly what attitude the new government will take, but it seems unlikely that they would throw out the agreements if the Inuit wish to retain them. So those negotiations are dragging along. And one of the big issues in it is the question of advisory power or decision-making power in relation to certain subject matter. On the Nunavut government side, we have been having discussions with the federal politicians and officials. They're aware of our proposals. We discuss things back and forth. There is the possibility that things could move quickly if the political will were there, and really that depends more at the moment on an accommodation being reached between the eastern and western portions of the Northwest Territories on mutual concerns, such as the location of a boundary, such as the, let's say, management of caribou herds crossing any boundary and things like that. In a sense, the ball is in the court of the northerners, so one can't really fault the Canadian government at the moment. And then the third process, the national constitutional one, Inuit have not yet tabled their self-government paper. And I can tell you, however, that the self-government paper, assuming it survives in anything like its present form, does contain a lot of material on different cases, including the North Slope Borough and other situations abroad, and is an attempt to look at practical achievements in self-government elsewhere. And as a result of this conference, I'll be suggesting that we look at a few more. And then trying to persuade the Canadian governments that progress is achievable. Actually, the provincial governments, who have nothing whatever to do with Nunavut, Nunavut can be created without any reference to the provincial governments. It can't be a province without the other provincial governments agreeing, but you can create as a territory this afternoon. The thing that's interesting is the provinces, who have no stake, have been pushing for Nunavut because the fact that it is a public government structure has made some of them feel it isn't that nice, and really that's the kind of model one could go with, and they'd rather hear about that than some proposals from different parts of the country for what they regard as extremely radical government structures. So the provinces have actually been cheerleading on this one, to our surprise.
Because it's not a tribal government.
Yeah, and it's nice and far from them.
Then I have one other question, and that is that in my paper I described the Cope settlement as having a number of corporate structures that were set up, and I think that it would be well to talk for just a moment or ask you to respond. You were describing to me yesterday that the ownership under the Cope settlement by the native population, although the ownership is in a corporation, it is a corporation in which every member of the native population, as they come on, are born, are automatically members of that corporation. It's in fee simple, but it is non-transferable. That is, in a sense, it looks like what we're talking about, land in trust held by the United States government. It doesn't look like the corporate form of ownership that we see in the regional or village corporations. I think, although it's called corporate ownership, if you look through that word, through those words, you see that it is permanent ownership, it is available to every child of a native who comes into the community, and it is non-transferable except under unusual circumstances. Now, having made that statement, Peter, could you correct me if I'm...
No, that's correct, and that Tom probably knows more about the intricacies, but no, that's quite correct, and I should say that it's not a big issue in Canada. There's no particular opposition to that. It's an accepted principle. You know, in further land claim settlements, it seems unlikely that people will be upset. In other words, it's readily accepted, and it's already at work, of course, in the James Bay and Northern Quebec settlement.
And lastly, the mineral ownership, although it's owned by the Crown, it essentially is substantially controlled or effectively controlled by the native population. Is that, how would you describe that?
No, it definitely isn't so controlled. There are possibilities under legislation in relation to oil and gas and administration of federal lands that native share or native involvement can be developed. But essentially, the mining industry has told the Canadian government that they want jurisdiction absolutely vested in governments, not in Aboriginal corporations or other Aboriginal, specifically Aboriginal structures. And I don't know if they needed to tell the government, because I think the government would view it that way anyway, but the Inuit can participate in mining development, for instance, through development corporations is set up, but that's, you know, really no big deal. But no, the question of non-renewable resources is really the big one, and one where all the native groups in northern Canada are working together, because the Canadian government to date has been absolutely resistant to the idea of any amount of Aboriginal control, or even of a formula for Aboriginal revenue sharing.
Charles Wilkinson.
To ask another question about the difference between public and tribal governments, certainly one thing that I'm sure Alaska Natives are concerned about is possible demographic changes in the future in rural areas. And of course, with a public government, if there are non-natives who move in and become a majority, then because it is a public voting situation, they can assume control. Over a period of 10, 25, 50 years, Do you believe those demographic changes will occur in your region? And if so, what degree of disquiet do you have about the possible ramifications I'm suggesting?
Well, yes, they could change over time. We don't foresee any immediate changes, and we've got studies on the oil and gas and mineral picture and so on. On the other hand, Canadian government policy can develop and change rather dramatically. And if a government, for various reasons, wanted to promote oil and gas development in the Arctic, it could bring in something very quickly. So you're right that that's a problem. My own feeling personally is that the Nunavut Constitution work has insufficiently looked at this question, because although it's being considered under land claims, and again, I should stress that anything achieved there is absolute protection for all time, so that if one is looking at certain matters relating to culture, which indeed is part of the subject matter, and local communities, then you know, there are protections achievable. So that shouldn't be a problem in terms of, you know, taking over an existing community. But yes, in terms of political structures, there is a long-term danger. I don't think it's been adequately addressed. And yet, whenever it's been discussed in the Nunavut Forum, whose meetings are public, there's never been any will on the part of people to build in special considerations. I don't know to what extent that's tactical. I don't know to what extent they're saying, well, look, let's not get the wind up in Ottawa any sooner than we need to. I think there's an assumption that with a land claim settlement and with a public government, a legislature controlled by Inuit is going to have a good many years to consolidate the position of the population within the area. And, you know, whether that's an idle hope or not, I don't know. Certainly at one of the constitutional conferences, the Manitoba Métis, the mixed-blood people in Manitoba, reminded the Inuit very forcibly that the province of Manitoba, which was created by the action of Indian and Métis people in 1870, had various rights guaranteed for that population, and these were very quickly eroded. So I think that right now it's a judgment call, but there are protections possible through land claims, and certainly the Inuit elected leadership are very, very anxious to make sure that a land claim settlement in Nunavut is not just a cash and land settlement, but does contain a number of features that one might call political.
David Case.
My understanding of the Northern Quebec settlement is that there are built in, and maybe it's not a part of the settlement, but of the regional government in northern Quebec, is that there is a fixed ratio for representation for communities. In other words, and I think the maximum that any community can have on the municipal assembly, the regional assembly, is 2 per community, which means that native communities now hold all seats on the government, but that if there are new communities that grow up, they will be limited, and of non-natives, they'll be limited to 2. Is there such a provision or a idea embodied in Nunavut, or is it more a one man, one vote arrangement?
Well, at the moment, there isn't such a proposal embodied. And so it's being discussed, the whole question of having community based representation, and there's some big problems with that, by the way, but it is being discussed, and you're right that the situation in Quebec is as you described, so that even if one new community were created tomorrow around a mineral resource and it had twice the population of the total Inuit population in the area, you're right, it would still have minimal representation. However, of course, if you have a number of such communities, then the picture begins to change.
Ralph Lerner.
I have a question about the, what to me surprising, transconstitutional status of land claim settlements. What does that special status rest on?
An amendment to the Canadian Constitution agreed in brought into force in 1982, Section 25 of the Constitution Act 1982, and also in 1983. At a constitutional conference, there was a further provision agreed, which is now being, as I guess, I don't know if it's been enacted yet by all the legislatures, but which also regards land claim settlements as constitutional documents and gives some further status of some kind.
So it's a constitutional amendment.
Oh, yeah.
Is that an amendable part of the Constitution?
It's amendable, but it would take seven provinces plus the national government, seven provinces representing 50% of the Canadian population and the national government to do it.
You mean it's harder to unamend it than to amend it in the first place, or it's the same process?
The amending formula was one of the things that came into force the same day, so it slipped in under the wire, you might say. But I think based on the experience of November 1981, when the provinces and the national government tried to take out some amendments promised to the Native community, the national reaction was so vociferous that I don't think any Canadian government would ever try that again, because the Canadian people may not know much about Aboriginal concerns, but they certainly have an elemental sense of fairness which was violated by the attempt to break a promise.
The just a footnote to that, the when the new constitution was hammered out in 1982, Native people said, well, we are going to be settling land claims for the next generation, and you've got all these provisions about equal protection and mobility of hire, and we're worried, and there are provisions in our settlements that the land can't be sold, and so on and so forth, and we're worried that the new Charter of Rights might be used to undermine our settlements. So the governments agreed that land claim settlements would automatically be entrenched in the Constitution and could not be changed merely by Parliament passing a law. There had to be a constitutional amendment. It's a remarkable provision. Yeah, question, Charlie?
Between Canada and United States, as you well know, that there is an oil treaty between Canada and United States. And as part of the American function and the American responsibility, that Native participation was mandated on the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And then it carried over to Canada, and what are the groups doing in Canada to secure those portions that the Americans and the Canadians have already signed in place to secure these job preferences in energy-oriented matters as part of the condition of the permit between Canada and United States for the Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts of Alaska on this side? What is Canada doing to secure these rights and have been resolved by our governments?
Can you answer that, Peter?
I can. I'm sorry, Charlie.
I wonder, before you leave off, Peter, there's another country where there have been recent developments regarding Native government, and that's Norway. And the Norwegian government has recently published a four-volume report about Native rights in Norway. And Peter, you're the only person I know who's able to read Norwegian. Could you tell us in 5 minutes what the Norwegian report says about the rights of the Sami people of Norway?
Yes. There's a committee, the Sami Rights Committee, that was set up, I guess, in 1980. And it represents, or rather it comprises various interest groups, including some, shall we say, not dreadfully progressive social forces in the Sami areas, and a few Sami representatives. It's supported by an expert subcommittee of international lawyers. In Norway, interestingly, most of the legal and policy thinking in relation to Aboriginal issues is coming from international law. And this is something that certainly the Canadian Department of Justice finds intriguing. There will be three reports of this committee. The first one is out. The first one proposes that there be a national Aboriginal parliament, a Sami parliament, that has a direct link with the national general parliament. There's a controversy because in the first report, the powers proposed for this parliament are merely advisory, although the national parliament is required to debate and discuss their annual